Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. Purple Tuna was asking, does anyone know, is it better to oil or wax one's leather chair? I don't know about leather. I just know about hair. And for hair, it's wax always. Wax is better. That's what I use for the show. How are you doing, people of the regular chat? Carlota was asking if I'm unbanned from Twitter. I am not, which leads me to believe that this is not a true amnesty. Certainly, it is not yet a true amnesty, a true general amnesty. General means general. Mexico, bullets are flying in the air because they've arrested the son of El Chapo, who was the kind of supervising, leading a cartel of whatever, drugs or illegal stuff, and they arrested him. El Chapo is already in jail, so his son now goes to join him, and the partisans of El Chapo and his son have taken to the street, and they're starting a kind of criminal overtake of a city. I believe that most of the action is in the state of Sinaloa. They started shooting on planes, not killing anyone or hurting anyone, but just shooting on planes that were about to take off. So the passengers had to take cover, and now they closed the airport. You can see them in a jeep right here, and shooting toward the plane, which is there. We don't really hear on the video, but we see certainly that they are pursuing a plane that's about to take off, and they're shooting bullets at it. We can see the sparks coming up, and here we can see the partisans of El Chapo just surrounding, circling the airport, and the employees being very scared. Or maybe it was a personnel of the army coming to, or police coming to intervene. I don't know, but in any case, it was related to the partisans of El Chapo. So some people are stuck because the airport is down, and it is recommended by the Canadian government that if you are in Sinaloa, to seek cover, seek shelter, and don't move from there. Do not attempt to pass the barricades that are being established by the partisans of El Chapo. I don't know, is Mexico capable of handling a little revolution of criminals like this? Or is the criminal network in Mexico stronger than the government? I have no idea. I don't know how it will turn out. I think that in Western civilization, a bunch of criminal like this with a couple of gun would be taken down by forces of authority. But in a more unstable country, a country that has less means to available to them, who knows? Maybe the cartel is bigger than the government. End of the line, Joel says, Twitter will continue to be a capricious environment, even those people unbanned. Some will be banned again for spam. There is no transparency. It's what is greatly disappointing in the whole Elon Musk general amnesty thing. It's that someone commented that it was a billionaire's play toy now. And that's what it is. And to those people who come to me and say, JF, it's probably that they forgot you. It's probably that they didn't notice your account. Shut the fuck up. You don't know what's going on here. What Elon Musk is attempting to do is exactly the same as Getter was trying to do, which is to centralize the center right, to abolish anything to their right so that they're the only people standing. And they're trying to create within the Overton window a space of debate among the centrist politicians, the Charlie Kirks of this world, and they will promote only them. And go to Truth Social, same thing. Center, 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 all of the accounts at the top of the screen, it's all Donald Trump, Charlie Kirk, and Jack Posobiec. Clearly, what we have here is a cartel establishing in three different ways: Getter, Truth, and now Twitter. The goal of these cartels is precisely to abolish legitimate conversations about the truth and to replace it with what the Charlie Kirks of this world have to serve you. Total Grimm says, why was England let back on? It does make you a kind of a conspiracy theorist when you see that Andrew England is back on, but that I'm not. It makes you realize that this establishment of a cartel may be finer than even just banning the far right, but leaving the most stupid of them up is is a step further. I mean, I've always said Andrew England is a poor thinker, a poor debate performer, a poor intellectual. And the fact that he would be, and of course, he uses the racial slurs profusely on his website. So if there's any ground to have a terms of service at Twitter that would ban anything about race, certainly Andrew England would fall under it. And yet he's back on. Is he at the service of agency that want him back on? Is he a good punching bag for the center right? I don't know, but it looks like it. Ladazal says, also, why doesn't Odyssey feed me ads for JF? Just saw one for Lauren Sutton. Ads, certainly I don't expect ads to be featured in ads because I don't pay for ads, so I wouldn't expect to be in ads. I don't know what you saw from Lauren Sutton, but maybe it's paid. You have to consider this. Carlota says, tiny accounts and radical accounts were unbanned. Musk is afraid of TRP. Ah, is it that Elon Musk wouldn't want to find himself intentionally not reading TRP? And by not bringing me back to Twitter, he can argue that he's not intentionally not reading TRP. I think you may have touched on something solid here. Anyways, this is not the subject today, nor is Mexico the subject today. I want to talk about the amateur criminal that Mr. Koberger is, and the many mistakes that he committed, and the state of the current tools available to police when they investigate a murder. Koberger was probably planning for this murder a relatively long time. He had studies specifically in the field of cloud forensics. That is one thing. When you are studying in cloud forensics, what are you studying? You're studying the computational ways in which someone can be traced back to a crime, or we can find a suspect for a crime. And you are therefore aware of all the techniques available to policemen with DNA. You are aware of car surveillance, cell phone surveillance. You are aware, or you should be aware, of the fact that basically every single gun in America, if found, can be tested for the pattern that it imprints on bullets, because there is the term may be stifling or something like stifflings. There's a term to describe the shape of the cannon, because a bullet of a gun, and today we're going to discuss all of the details of forensics, our policemen caught Koberger and how they could catch someone else. But to be clear, I'm covering this from a news perspective and not for the purpose of recommending crime or glorifying crime, just to understand just how good police are now. Yes, the term is rifling. The rifling of the cannon, because a bullet these days doesn't have enough explosive so that if it was just to explode and shoot toward you, it couldn't kill you in most instances. You'd have to be very unlucky to be killed by a bullet that is simply thrown by the explosive. the very important feature that is present in modern guns is a swirl that is engraved within the cannon of every gun. That swirl takes the bullets and, because of its characteristics with aerodynamics, makes the bullet turn like a football. Now, think about if you throw a football, but you don't make it spin. It won't have very good aerodynamic properties. It won't go very far. It will be falling to the ground relatively quick. That is why every good quarterback would spin the football. As the football spins, it gives it better aerodynamic properties, better speed, better control, better stability, and pointing, most importantly. An object that is not spinning will not stay in the same axis as when it was launched, therefore causing problem with the wind, and also arriving at your target, maybe on the side. If a bullet was to arrive on the side toward your skin like this, it would not easily penetrate you. So this, the rifling of guns is extremely important to have the bullet stably pointing and the point that is intended to enter the target arriving at the target with the point forward. Now, this comes at a disadvantage for criminals, however. The rifling is like a fingerprint. It can be traced back to a single gun. That is why if you don't succeed at fully destroying or hiding in a permanent manner a gun, eventually they will, with combination of database rifling studies, they will be able to link the gun to a crime, and they will then be able to link a gun to you. Koberger must have been aware of all this, which is why he chose to go for knife murders. But he committed these knife murders in such an amateur way that you could question whether he actually knew this about riflings, and whether he made the conscious choice of going for the knife for that purpose. Because the errors that he's committed can be listed as 5 different points. Because now we have, since this morning, the affidavit of probable cause, and so that tells us everything that the police knew at the moment of asking for him to be fully arrestable and arrested. So the 5 points, 4 of them are listed on my thumbnail. 1 is not listed on the thumbnail: leaving a witness alive. Koberger, as it turns out, committed his murders in around 4:17 a.m. 4:17 a.m. in Moscow, Idaho. And I want to show you, I got a map from Google Map to show you the travel, which will become important, and we'll talk about how ultimately his car gave him away very much. Koberger works here and lives here in Pullman. He works at the Washington State University. At a little later than 2 a.m., Koberger goes, and we can see through his cell phone tracing that he goes toward this direction. The murders happen here in Moscow, Idaho, in a little residence where 4 students were living together. The 4 students who got killed. But a roommate has been left alive. A woman who was a roommate of these 4 people has been left alive. What happened is that from 2 a.m., where Koberger is here, according to his cell phone records, he eventually shuts down his cell phone. But he shuts down his cell phone as he had already taken the route. And so if you're a policeman and you know that, well, Koberger was here around 2 a.m. and then cell phone shuts up, of course he kept going. he kept going on his route. He was already in a Moscow direction, in the direction of Moscow, when he gave away his cell phone position. And then his cell phone shuts down and wakes up back around 5 a.m. after the murders. And when they reconstructed the path, it seems to me that Koberger made one straight path at one point in that morning, and then that he made a detoured path here. So taking the 95 south, going around, and then coming back to Pullman. What I think has happened here in the two paths is that first, one of the path could be him returning from the murder. So he returns from the murder. He doesn't want to give his cell phone position away, going straight back to Washington State University. So he takes a random route, ends up on the 95 here. Ends up on the 95 south, travels for a while also being extremely nervous, and eventually returns to Washington State University. It's too obvious. You've just taken the major routes going toward Genesee Valley, and then you turned west and you came back to Washington. Now, the only dark spot that we have is between here and here. So it's evident that something happens in 3 hours that both leads to the murder happening here in Moscow, and then his cell phone to wake up and communicate with the cell towers once he's south on 95. Go away, says Jeff. Wait, you're telling me this guy crossed state lines? I hope he gets the death penalty. There are no state lines here. He crossed city lines. So crossing city lines is a misdemeanor, not a felony. You cannot get the death penalty for this. John Drake says, even if he didn't have a cell phone, a modern car is enough to cook you with all the chips in these things. Everything is recorded. Yeah, so going back to my list of errors. So the first error is, in this house, he commits four murders. He surprised the people around 4:17 a.m., killed them in their sleep, some of them. Presumably some of them could have had the chance to wake up, but didn't get any self-defense means in a quick enough way. He was able somehow to knife four different people, including one guy, with a knife. But another person is looking at some point into the apartment. She was somehow outside or in a separate room. She opens the doors and sees him. He is covered in black clothing, including stuff that covers his face. But she recognizes the eyebrow. She doesn't recognize at that time who that is, but she sees the eyebrows. And the eyebrows of Koberger are extremely dominant. You know, they are very specific eyebrows. So she retains that details. Koberger advances toward her as she hears some screaming inside, some crying. And apparently, we have some audio recording from camera securities not so far that are catching some dogs barking at 4:17. You know, all of this made noise, and the noise was detectable. As far as the roommate who was left alive, it seems that she was in a state of shock. Koberger just walks in front of her, and she is in a state of shock, and somehow he doesn't kill her while he has killed just four people. Ultimately, one of the errors here that he committed is that he let his eyebrows be recognizable. He may have thought he was invincible. He may have thought, I have enough clothes on my face, she wouldn't recognize me. But his eyebrows were identified, and eventually an investigator saw a picture of Koberger and said, that totally fits what this girl told me. That is just one element, but it's one element that adds. Eyebrows recognized, and a witness left alive. The Sixth Sense says they are only now saying that a survivor confronted him face to face, yet didn't report it for 6 hours later. What don't add up here? I mean, I won't go into theories of the police somehow, you know, creating a story that is fake for the purpose of hiding their true way of finding him. I think it's interesting, and I think we should keep those hypotheses in mind. But it would be conspiratorial thinking to think at this stage that we're being bombarded with a lie here. I think that the story we're being told, although there may be omissions, very important omissions. First, the one thing I learned today, and I learned it, well, I learned it yesterday just after the show, is that the FBI had ordered that Koberger be arrested for speeding. Now, this is wild. They had asked the police, can you follow this car and find some reason to arrest him? This sounds illegal to me. If you're lying about the probable cause of the reason of your arrest, and if you really have an FBI agent in the back saying, yeah, this car, find something about it, it seems to me that this is illegal. I don't know. Now, of course, they will say, oh, this was not the important aspect of the investigation. And in fact, they didn't use that information at all or much. They mentioned these arrests, but they didn't talk about it as a crucial aspect of their investigation in the affidavit. John Drake says pretext is definitely illegal, and yet this is what's reported by Fox News. So I mean, you cannot be arresting someone and saying, I'm arresting you because you were following that van too closely. But behind you have another reason, which is you're investigating this person for murder. Now, is it illegal in the sense that he would be entitled to not be found guilty? Or is it illegal in the sense that they could not use the evidence gathered from these arrests in a court of law? This is very different because sometimes police will try to get illegally and obtain information just to convince themselves that there is some truth to it, but then they won't use it in court, and I don't know, I feel extremely uncomfortable about this. In my principles of justice, in my own moral code, there should not be a single violation of your rights. A violation of your right could add up to you being found guilty, even if the data is not used in a court of law. The Sixth Sense says, if evidence is found or obtained by illegal means, the evidence is tossed, indeed. That is not enough to me. that is not enough. We have it in the Canadian Constitution that if your rights have been violated at any point of a process, this process should be abolished. Now, they don't follow that. It's in the Constitution, but they don't seem to care about it. But in my view, that should be what it is. That should be what it is. Not just you are not allowed to use that evidence, but you are not allowed to prosecute this man. Anyway, putting this on the side, Cloud Warmer has sent two super chats. He says, Jeff, it seems that the tactic is to intercept at the extremes and then guide people back to an approved middle ground. There is no room for real discussion apart from approved talking points and distractions. Get upset about something, have a fight online, and meanwhile some other shit going on. That was in relation to Twitter being now a centrist dictatorship. Cloud Warmer says, JF, maybe the FBI were doing signals intelligence or had a tip off in some similar manner. This happens in Australia. AFP/AZO monitor your online communications and will intercept potential criminals before crimes occur. If they have said online they plan to do something, terrorists are caught this way. Yeah, but clearly here we are not in an investigation of terrorism. We are in an investigation of murders, and I believe that using a pretext to obtain evidence as part of the chain that leads you to conclude that he's the murderer is a problem. even if you hide it in the affidavit of probable cause later, it's still a problem, in my view. In my view, I know this is not how the law operates right now. Right now, they don't care. They will violate rights. But in my view, it's too much. Tillman says, Jeff, are we talking about the FBI here? Don't forget. No, I was not talking about the FBI, like Federal Bureau of Investigation. No, no, no. I was talking about the frazzled blueberries in Indiana. A spindly opinion sounds like pre-crime. Even end of the line, Joel says, even if he left his smartphone at home, his car license plate would surely have been detected by CCTV at some stage. Exactly. So we're going to get to it. The first error was leaving a witness alive with clues about his facial features. The second error is leaving item on the scene. He left his sheet that was the protective gown of his knife. Somehow forgot it on the bed. For a PhD in criminology, that is not someone I would give a PhD in criminology to. I mean, but I know that PhD now you can get them in cereal boxes, and okay, so that's the level of a PhD today. But he left the sheath of his knife, poof, right there on the crime scene. With a what? It wasn't what led his DNA to be found. It wasn't what led his DNA to be found. Somehow it wasn't I don't know that it wasn't, but that is not where they ended up finding his DNA. His DNA was found in the bed sheet. So he left too many clues there. I don't know that you can do a murder these days without having a full hazmat suit. If not on top of your clothes, perhaps below your under your clothes, you would have some kind of sealed container of your whole body. And the clothes that you use cannot be clothes from your wardrobe, clothes that you've been washing and not washing, doesn't matter. You've been touching these clothes. And the only way that I see would be a highly sterile environment with, I mean, you saw in Dexter, in the teleseries Dexter was basically using some kind of a hazmat suit. If you don't have that kind of full protection, you're going to leave some DNA samples somewhere. So he left a knife sheet and he left his DNA on the bed sheet. Now, he may have thought that his DNA was not a clue because he may have never been in a database and never had his DNA sampled. And there was lots of speculation in the last few days about him somehow giving, because this someone in the FBI team or police team that was working on this, someone leaked to the media that a technology of parental ancestral DNA has been used to find Koberger. This led people to conclude, oh my God, he gave his DNA to 23andMe. That's not what happens. Now we have the affidavit. This was all speculation. The reality is, here's what they did. Because of all their clues they had built on the white sedan, and they knew that there was a white car, that it had to be this white car that was related to the murders, and they knew that Koberger was working at Washington State University. They got the camera video surveillance from Washington State University, saw that he was indeed driving every morning, every night, this car from his employment place. And so they went to his father in Pennsylvania. Now, this is a advanced method, and it's someone called it an overreach on Gab, but I think it's legal because of the legal history and legal precedent. They went to his father's house without telling his father. They digged into his father's trash. They got a DNA sample from his father by looking into his father's trash. Then they made the parental test on this DNA versus the DNA that was on the bed sheets. And they said they found with 99.9998% certainty that the murderer had to be the son of his father in Pennsylvania. So now they had the car. This car goes to Washington State University. This car is owned by Koberger. So he's been arrested before for speeding, for example, and the police had seen Koberger inside the car. So now you have the car, his workplace, and you have the genetic link to the scene. Because you know that the person who must have committed this murder must be the son of Koberger's father who lives in Pennsylvania. And yes, it is legal to collect from trashes because this has been decided at the Supreme Court level many decades ago. It is not a violation of privacy because when you drop something in the trash, you don't expect it to be private. You expect it to be gathered by a public official. So it's like throwing something to the trash legally is like entering a police station and giving them the documents. Basically, the trash are part of the police station. That's how you need to understand it. So, yes, an error there in terms of leaving DNA on the bed sheet and then assuming that without a full sealed hazmat protection, that DNA would not lead back to him. You don't have to be in a record or database to be found by paternal techniques. They will go to your father's home and your father is not prepared to sterilize his own trash. So you don't even have to commit a mistake here. A family member of yours can commit the mistake. Thomas O'Ward says, did JF say the match was made through mitochondrial DNA? Then it definitely wasn't from a blood source. No, I didn't say mitochondrial DNA. I said that they did a paternal test. A paternal test generally implies we're going to look at all of the autosomal genes, that is the whole genome, and we're going to also look at the Y chromosome, and we're going to see, does this person have 50% of the genes from this person? If so, then if every chromosome has one chromosome that can be found in the father, then that would be highly certain that it's a father. The degree of error is infinitesimally small. The degree of error is pretty fucking small, okay? The sixth sense, what about the change in registration for the car? Conveniently timed, by the way. This didn't attract my attention. I believe I've read that there was a change of registration for the car in June. That would be a couple of months ago. That didn't alarm me. It was a change of registration from what, Pennsylvania to Idaho, something like this. That would be just Koberger moving from his parents' house to his new PhD job or to a job that he may have had for many years, but that he didn't take the time to change his registration since. End of the line, Joel says, JF, so your true purpose of the COVID hazmat video in 2020 becomes clear now. Ha ha, you got me. Thomas O'Ward says, the degree of error from paternal DNA testing is good enough for many, many hilarious Maury Povich daytime scandal TV episodes. Exactly. You can know when you listen to Maury that you get the truth. All right, so leaving items on the scene, that was the second error. The third error is... let me look at my list here. The third item of error is the lack of care in defending against video surveillance of cars. There is CCTV everywhere. Private lands. I have CCTV in my house. If there was a murder, I could see maybe from the street corner. I somehow catch the street on one of my, accidentally, on one of my cameras. So if there was a murder, I would have weeks of recording of who passed here and when. And the problem when you have weeks of recording is you're going to get not just the moment of the murder, you're going to get all the potential going back and forth, studying his scene, preparing for his scene, and going to the scene after the crime. So the car following was probably one of the most solid elements they had before getting all this father DNA. Because to get the father DNA, you have to have a suspicion on Koberger specifically. But they had CCTV of things on the streets. They had various spots. And they could see that a white sedan at 2 a.m. goes from Pullman toward Moscow, is around the area where you would expect the where the murders have happened. And so they had a lot of surveillance. They also have him on various surveillance videos on these highways that he uses as detours. They have him everywhere. They have him at his job. They have him at his job before he goes for the murder. They have him at his job later. They have him at his job the whole month. So that's just, you barely can commit a crime these days with a car. These days, it's all on foot. The Sixth Sense says if they really wanted the car found, they would have released the plate numbers, both plate numbers. Well, no, sometimes first you're waiting for evidence. So sometimes you are not sure of your call. Sometimes you want to acquire more evidence. Sometimes also you want to leave a suspect to commit errors. You want to put them under surveillance so that they can't escape, but you don't have to arrest them immediately. They might commit errors. In fact, they might commit errors that lead other people to be implicated in the crime. You may not be sure. You know, you may wonder, is his father involved in these murder? So you might want to let some time pass to let them commit mistakes or catch them in a red-handed bag situation where you catch them going out at 3 a.m. to throw the weapon of the crime somewhere. You want to catch these things sometimes, so no, I will not have a reproach to the police work here for the time that it took. I think it was a wise investigation and a top-of-the-line investigation against a not-top-of-the-line murderer. Trying to stay white-pilled says, annoying how they present him as some kind of ultra-high IQ savant killer. Bro, you study criminal justice. High IQ people don't study criminal justice. Ever. That is true. That is true. I don't know of any clever people, like highly intelligent people, going for this path of career. It just doesn't exist. If you're somewhat intelligent, like higher level than this guy, you would end up in hard science, in computer science, maybe in math, never in criminology. That is a second grade branch of study. Eyes of a Statue says, in the US, we are often operating on Ring doorbell footage, not CCTV, because smaller towns don't have pervasive public CCTV. Well, it seems they had plenty. I mean, you have a university there. A university is always equipped. Highways are always equipped with that stuff. So it seems that this was plenty. Plenty to trace him just based on the car. So that was the third error. The fourth error is the lack of care with defense against cell phone surveillance. He used such a rudimentary approach with cell phone surveillance that it's absolutely shameful. First, when he left Pullman around 2 a.m., they have a trace of him catching new towers on the way there. So they have a trace of him already getting on his way. Then he shuts down his phone. But and they even have a Washington State University footage that's compatible with this direction on the 270 here. So they know exactly where he's going. Look at the 270. It's not like it branches off in a dozen directions. The 270 is the road you take to get to Moscow, and they knew he was on there starting at 2-3 a.m. So he gets to Moscow. By the way, this driving distance here is 13 minutes. So I'm fascinated by the fact that he starts at 2-3 a.m., 13 minutes travel. I'm fascinated to understand, and I don't understand yet, what does he do between 2-3 a.m. plus 13 minutes of travel? What does he do for 1 hour, at least 1 hour, around Moscow, being spotted for his car? And we know he's in Moscow, but the murders only happen at 4:17 a.m. I would suspect basically that he's stalking, that he's studying, that he has all the items, but it's quite a long time. It's quite a long time to stay and just talk. Is he preparing? Is he making sure that everyone is sleeping? Because one of the fascinating aspects here is that he ends up committing the murders around 4:17 a.m., but there was activity on a TikTok app on a cell phone of one of the victims 17 minutes earlier. At 4 a.m. And there were DoorDash deliveries at 3:30 a.m. so yes, Eyes of a Statue says waiting for DoorDash to leave. That's probably what is happening here. He is stalking, preparing, making sure that they're sleeping, but it's taking a while. And there is activity up to 17 minutes before the murder. So perhaps he had access to some cue in terms of lighting that was revealing to him that they were not yet sleeping. John Drake says, with all this, 80% of murders in Mexico go unsolved. This says a lot about who runs the country over there. Yes, there are some murders that they probably don't want to really find the suspect for. The Sixth Sense says, his professor said, he was an excellent student that performed at the top of his class for all intents and purposes. Yes, but the top of a class, of a psychology class, of a criminology class, you may be the only artist in there, you know? All of the good artists have been filtered through in biomedical science, MD, and mathematics. So I don't know how we can draw conclusions from this. So in any case, one thing I find that was one thing I find fascinating. More than 1 hour passed somewhere here around the house, waiting for the DoorDash guy to go, waiting for the TikTok activity on the cell phone to end, and then he commits his murders. Another fascinating thing that, beside the detour taken here between the 95, the 195, and perhaps we can read the description just so you can know how much the police can know about your trajectory, even if you turn off your cell phone. Because he turned off his cell phone, but they have the point where he turned it off, the point where he turns it back on. They can draw conclusions from this. So let's read this part of the affidavit. further review indicated. Further review indicated that the 8458 phone utilized cellular resources on November 13 that are consistent with the found leaving the area of the Koberger residence at approximately 9 a.m. and traveling to Moscow, Idaho. Specifically, the phone utilized cellular resources that would provide coverage to the King Road residence between 9:12 a.m. and 9:21 a.m. That is one thing that fascinates me. He went back. He did his old detour after the murders around 4:17 a.m. Was too nervous, went back to his Pullman residence. At 9 a.m., left his residence, went straight to Moscow, Idaho. I think that what he's trying to do here, and he's leaving his cell phone open this time. I think that what he's trying to do here is to create a history of, oh yeah, you know, traveling to Moscow, Idaho is a regular thing for me. I mean, I wasn't there at the moment of the murder 5 hours earlier. But I was there. I was there. That's true. You might see me on some CCTV cameras. I was there, but I was there at 9:12 a.m. Sometimes a murderer will kind of create stories in his head about what will I say if they ask me this. And even after the murder, they will develop parallel stories to be able to stand credibly in front of police and say, oh yeah, I was in Moscow, I don't know exactly when. No, probably not 4 a.m. No, but I was there maybe around 8, 9. I think this is what he's doing here. This is a murderer, nervous and stuck in Pullman now after his 4 murders, and he's thinking, what can I do with my cell phone open that could throw them off? I could drive at 9 a.m. Drive at 9 a.m. to Moscow, Idaho, and say, yeah, I regularly go to Moscow, Idaho. But they got his whole month of history of cell phone travel, and that is not a regular thing he was doing. He was regularly driving to places buying stuff, but not to Moscow, Idaho. So that is one thing that retained my attention. Now for the meat of the subject, that is the description of the travel in and around the murder time. On November 13 at approximately 2:42 a.m., the phone was utilizing resources around the Koberger residence, so in Pullman where he lives. At approximately 2:47 a.m., the phone utilized resources that provide coverage southeast of the Koberger residence, consistent with the phone leaving the Koberger residence and traveling south through Pullman, Washington. Is that Washington? This is consistent with the movement of the white Elantra. At approximately 2:47 a.m., the phone stops reporting to the network, which is consistent with either the phone being in an area without cellular coverage, the connection to the network is disabled, or that the phone is turned off. The phone does not report to the network again until approximately 4:48 a.m., at which time it utilized cellular resources that provide coverage to ID State Highway 95 south of Moscow, Idaho, near Blaine, Idaho. Between 4:50 a.m. and 5:26 a.m., the phone utilizes cellular resources that are consistent with the phone traveling south on Idaho State Highway 95 to Genesee ID, then traveling west toward Uniontown ID, and then north back into Pullman. At approximately 5:30 a.m., the phone is utilizing resources that provide coverage to Pullman and consistent with the phone traveling back to the Koberger residence. So let me summarize this with the map. They see him exit Pullman on southern direction with the phone on. He turns off his phone. So we don't know what he's doing, but I would guess what he's doing is this. Commit his murder at 4:17 a.m. The phone is still not back on, but he turns back his phone at 4:48 a.m. here. He turns back his phone as he's going back home. He's going back home. And his phone is still on as he gets back to Pullman. He merely stopped his phone. First, the general philosophy about phone is that even if they're turned off, you wouldn't know if there is a device inside the phone that allows illegal pingings of some kind. You wouldn't know if the phone may use the battery while you don't know. And so generally the philosophy is a phone cannot be carried on you if you expect privacy, even if turned off. But there is another degree to this when you're talking about forensics and criminality, is that leaving your phone off at home is also not a solution. Leaving your phone off at home gives you the full window of the alibi that you need. So I believe that a crime that would fool authorities would be one that takes that into account and would use some kind of emulator, virtualization software, to simulate human activity on the phone in that time window. You cannot commit a four murders while having partial information sent to the cell towers. So we had, he left Pullman, he closed his phone here, but too late, they already knew. He goes to commit the murder, he turns back his phone while on the 95 South. And it's too obvious. Now, so that would be the U-shaped trajectory that he has done early in the morning at the time of the murders. And then at 9 a.m., 5 hours after committing the murder, he does a straight route with cell open to Moscow. Probably here with the explanation that I said earlier, nervousness and desire to set up the story in his mind that, yeah, it would be realistic to see his car, and he could plausibly say, yes, I was in Moscow, Idaho, but not exactly at that moment where the murders happened, but a totally amateur route on the first take, which totally cancels this this strategy of deception at 9 a.m. The Sixth Sense says, if you killed four people, would you ever turn it on? No, I mean, what I realize with this affidavit is they have a very fine understanding of cell phones being turned off, being a pattern in and of itself. You know how we sometimes say absence of evidence is not evidence of absence? But absence of evidence is definitely evidence. It's evidence of something. You know, most people basically don't turn their phone off anymore at all. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised that you can actually look at the whole of the U.S. Just sample those people who close their phones in certain specific times, and you're going to catch a lot of criminals just that way. It's amazing when you think about it, when you think about how knowing a lot leads the game to be completely set against criminals. So I believe that I may not have realized, but we've done the 5 points. So summarizing back the 5 points, one, a witness left alive. Two, parental DNA and DNA left on the bed sheets. Three, items left on the scene. So the sheath of a knife. Four, car surveillance. So the extensive network of car surveillance available to police is unprecedented in human history. You cannot go anywhere without being traced in some form. They're gonna find it. They're gonna find private videos, worst case scenario, but most of the time they will actually have access to public data. And five, cell phone surveillance. Those are the five errors that Koberger has committed, which led to his arrest. And on top of it, very interesting to rewatch these body cam videos of his arrest when he was just a stop for speeding behind a van, for following a van too close. When I showed the video yesterday, But now I look at that video again with new eyes, as I know that this policeman was sent there by the FBI. He was asked, can you find a reason to arrest him? And the FBI, what they were interested in, believe it or not, is to have an accidental sample of his hands, because they were suspecting that they may have traces of hands that would point to the suspect. And they wanted the body cam of the police to accidentally catch the hands of Koberger as he discusses with him. And these hands would then be fit to the criminal evidence found on the scene. It turns out that it wasn't the hands that was used as the most solid evidence, but perhaps it was an intermediary step in the investigation, eventually sending them to the definite strategy of DNA testing. And DNA testing specifically, they had tested the whole scene. They had a lot of DNA samples, but eventually they correlated it with what was found in his father's trash, and that gave the match. Not only is the murderer the son of this guy, but this guy is driving with his father, also going back to Pennsylvania after this very nervous event in his life. And that was it. All of this gives us insight into the work of police. It doesn't give us insight into the psychological motivations of Koberger. And I have to say, I'm still in the dark on these motivations. But it does look like Koberger, although he had acquired social status in being a PhD, he probably didn't perceive himself as very high on the social status scale. He had been bullied by females, he had been rejected by females. And you look at the guy. The guy isn't fat, and he's in PhD. He should be able to score a good woman. But somehow his social awkwardness had led to a lot of rejection. And I would suspect that it's some kind of an incel murder, that he selected a woman who he found beautiful to seek vengeance. That would be my conclusion up to now. But it's still a very gray thing to me what he had in his mind. And I hope that we get from him an honest delivery of why he did it, rather than a whole non-guilty plea and attempting to save himself and say, I didn't do it. I would like him to stand in front of the judge and say, this is what I had in mind, this is why I did it, because I'd like to have the psychological insight that he wanted to pursue as a PhD. He wanted to find what are the reasons that lead someone to murder. Well, you are now in the best position to answer this question, Koberger, will you? I would like to have honesty, and I think it would be good for the families of the victims. Mikronova has sent a super chat. He says, did you already estimate his IQ, or do you need more info on him? I would need to see him interact outside of the court, or at least if in the court as a witness. Because when you're in the court beside your lawyer and your lawyer told you to shut up, I can't extract very much information. My guess is he's been selected through the process of PhD. Which gives him maybe plus 10 in and of itself. Because we're not talking PhD in physics, PhD in mathematics, that would be plus 25. It gives him a plus 10 in criminology. So, and then, do I have other cues that tells me he's a highly creative and highly talented individual? Well, certainly not in this murder scene. In this murder scene, I see a botched murder here, a murder that was committed by someone who was in the best position. He's at a peak age in terms of physical shape. He should have known, because he studied cloud-based forensics. He knows about all this. He should have heard about this. He should know about the rifling. He should know about the cell phone surveillance. He should know about the car surveillance systems. That is what you would study in cloud-based forensics. So I can't give bonus points on IQ for this, so I'm stuck at plus 10. So I'm stuck at maybe this is a guy with 110 IQ. You know, it's very easy in the modern time to emulate autism and to make people believe that you're some kind of misunderstood genius. Because we have cultural elements like the Big Bang Theory, teleseries. And so, you know, you just have to be socially awkward, and people will assume that there's some sort of genius behind. The problem is we have a problem of imitation here. And whether you're a true awkward genius or you're just a guy taking the awkwardness to get the genius credit, the stolen valor of autism, I'm afraid that he may have had this, he may have been a case of stolen autism, stolen valor of autism. He didn't live the autism lifestyle, but he used it as a way to shock people. I believe that he may be perhaps first and foremost a psychopath, emulating an autistic psychopath. Micronova says Koberger is just a method researcher, like Christian Bale is a method actor. Exactly. Low level of creativity. A phony wannabe autistic, says Chuck Garrity. That sounds like this is what we have. And so a man who was deeply a true, the true classical psychopath, but there is such a thing as autistic psychopathy, and he was passing as an autistic psychopath. Cloud Warmer says, Jeff, maybe the FBI were doing signal. Okay, this one I had read. Cloud Warmer was saying also, okay, this one I had read. Okay, so there it is. Jeff, I watch quite a bit of JCS inspired content, which also often includes interrogations and other police operations as part of the review of the crime. Quite a few times, the police have been able to get information from Fitbits and Apple Watches as well. They can see vitals as well. Absolutely, absolutely. And so the problem is that the perf you know how, and I don't want to encourage crime. I am totally against crime. But you know, there's a term called the perfect crime, and can you get away with murder? These kinds of teleseries exist. Getting away with murder in 2023, because that's the current year, getting away with murder means not just turning off the electronics. Not certainly not turning off as you're on your way to the freaking murder. Like, you know what this guy probably thought? He thought, if I start driving that way and I turn off my cell phone, they can't possibly know that I was going that way. And it's like, okay, that might work. If you can provide a fake cellular signal from here at 4 a.m. But no, instead, what this guy does is he does this, which, okay, maybe a decent strategy. Claiming that, oh, I went south. I couldn't be in Moscow because I was in somewhere south here. Okay, and now I notice there is a state line here. So you weren't kidding earlier when you said to me that there was a guy on the regular chat who said he cruised state line. He fucking did. This little fucker cruised the state line. He was a cruiser. He was neither an autist nor a psychopath. He was a state line crosser. He kept crossing the line. Holy shit. Anyways, so this, okay, maybe. But then he turns back in his cell phone as he's going away from the scene of murder. So your excuse doesn't work anymore. Your whole plan has fallen because you turned it on here. Was this an error or was this because he's just too stupid? I don't know. But in any case, going back to the subject of the perfect crime. The perfect crime in 2023 does not involve turning off your electronics. It involves emulating a human being using your electronics through various software methods. It involves having an electronic alibi. You know, the equivalent in the 70s was just to have human beings say, oh no, I was having coffee with him in this time and we were in this other town. In 2023, you need not only a human alibi, you need an electronic alibi. And that could take the form of specialized technical software, pinging at different places, pre-positioned cell phones activating themselves and emulating your original cell phone in different positions than the murderer stood. It may involve a software running from home, activating your servers and your automated scripts in a way that seems human from the outside internet. There's just no getting away with murder without that kind of stuff these days. The Sixth Sense says 4chan and Reddit both are unreliable, to say the least. That would be a normal opinion. Yes, most people would say that. Colorado says, can ping data be contrived? Well, what do you mean contrived? I'm not sure what this question is. Can it be simulated? I think it could. I think it could with modifiable software. You know, these little cards that you put in your cell phone. You can also emulate by software having that card, right? Simulated. Yeah, so you could simulate having a card in a special phone, or you could use your phone to begin with and run a software that looks human from the outside when perhaps it would make a call, perhaps it would not make a call but send a text, perhaps it would browse the internet in a human way, perhaps it would chat with ChatGPT and bring back the old memories of these artificial intelligence discussions with ChatGPT. But yeah, that would be what is an electronic alibi. Micronova says, I'm not encouraging this, but I would like to say that if Koberger studied his targets, he could have seen the restaurants they use. He could have impersonated a DoorDash employee delivering a free giant meal for everyone that he is sure they will eat and use... I'm not going to read the rest. Basically, he's asking the question. I will rephrase your question. He's asking the question, why are murderers doing the murder physically rather than use a detoured means like poisoning through radiation, slowly poisoning through radiation therapy? That's his question. And my guess would be that when you're a true psychopath, you don't enjoy the slow grind of getting one cell at a time from your victim over years. I think that there must be something instinctive with physical violence that this type of criminal seeks. Especially if you see his actions. We still don't have evidence that he was knowing these people, although there is one of the fathers involved. One of the fathers of the victims said, I might see a link, but I won't talk about it publicly at this time. So there might be some link to these victims. But if we think of it either as he knew these victims a little bit, maybe, or not much, and you see this murder as mostly a revenge incel set of murders, then the physical violence aspect may have been necessary to his satisfaction that he had taken revenge against what he perceived was a female class living above him, dismissing him, rejecting him. Tillman says, JF, the best way to get away with murder would be to study every episode of Columbo. I think Columbo is a little outdated. The Sixth Sense says, look at the Reddit poster that involved himself into the Daryl Brooks trial, claiming he was a juror, that of which he later said it was a joke. Okay, I didn't know that this had happened. Micronova says, yeah, like it is an impulse and power over life of others for psychos. Yeah, I'm just asking for academic inquiry, which is why a non-psychopath finds such personal vicious attacks as too risky. Risk-seeking is one of the markers of psychopath, right? Yeah. Although, you know, the term risk-seeking is very improperly chosen, but that's what they call it in research. Risk-seeking versus risk-aversion. But I don't like the term seeking. Maybe risk neutral. We could say maybe that most humans are risk averted. That is, if there's a risk, you're going to consider it greatly in your decision. Like, you wouldn't go to a job where you have 20% chance of dying. So that is being risk averse, and it's being a normal human being. I would say that a psychopath like this is not necessarily risk-seeking, but he's risk-neutral. And that also fits the neurobiological data, because when you take these people who are called sociopath by current psychological standard, however loose that definition would be, you put them in the brain imaging, they don't have the normal activation of insula and amygdala regions involved in disgust and avoidance and strongly negative human emotions. So, but it's not like there's something more in their brain. They're not risk seeking. They're not necessarily excited at the idea of risk itself. It's just that the brain area doesn't light up. The brain areas that should make you like, no, I don't want to do it, they don't have it. So if you don't have it, you're not a risk seeker, in my view. You're risk neutral. But risk neutral is a psychopathology in the human world. Thomas Howard says, a risk seeker named Koberger, I would have expected him to be a rent seeker. Oh my god, the jokes. Cloud Warmer says, JF, why do you think he did this? Well, I shared my thoughts already. For now, I don't have more thoughts. It looks like an incel revenge murder of the kind, I can't have these beautiful women, therefore I'm going to kill these beautiful women so no one ever has them. A fantasy of revenge, in my view. On the loose evidence that we have up to now on intent, I think that he was in the mood of the Ukrainian guy in Tenet. If I can't have you, no one will. You know how he says this to the blonde girl before attempting to start beating her with a belt and eventually gives up and doesn't beat her with a belt? It's pretty much this. And it's also what this Ukrainian character in the movie Tenet does to the old world. He says, if the world can continue, if the future comes back toward us, and if I'm going to die from cancer, I'm going to bring the whole world down with me, and I will allow the reversion of entropy that totally destroys the future of planet Earth. I think we have a man like this, very much like the Ukrainian guy in this movie. So we can review quickly the news that I had highlighted, but tonight I mostly wanted to talk about these murders, because we finally get good insight into you're right, he was not Ukrainian, he was Russian. But it does end up in a Ukrainian scene at the opera. But you're right, the opera was Ukrainian, but the guy was Russian. Sorry about this. I wanted to talk about these murders because I didn't cover them at all up to now, but now that we're starting to have decent information, I'm more comfortable doing deep dives. Opinion in CNN, the awkward truth about the new Avatar is far bigger than its bottom line. So the argument of this article is that Avatar 2, the big problem with Avatar 2 and James Cameron is that James Cameron has not involved the First Nations, the Native Americans. He has inspired his whole universe from them, but he denied them an opportunity to actually contribute in some deep way to his movies, and that he should work alongside the Native Americans for Avatar 3. It's a woke argument, but I kind of agree with it in the sense that, okay, you could do this for Avatar 3, but this shouldn't be a reason to dismiss a movie, though. And let's not forget that, according to my two-layer theory of a metaverse of Avatar, this whole thing is not another planet. It's a virtual world, and the natives of this virtual world are not natives of a planet. They are natives of a CPU. They are natives in the sense that they are software beings that were never human in the first place, that were never blue humans in the first place either. John Drake says, "Your great theory on Avatar wasn't true, unfortunately." Well, I'll watch Avatar 2 and I'll draw my own conclusions. We'll see. There may be no evidence in Avatar 2 that it's true, but that doesn't mean that it's false. You could set whatever Avatar 2 shows up to be, turns out to be, could be just within a metaverse of my theory, which is a two-layer metaverse. We'll see what they say. This was the article I was referring to, which I find extremely borderline, not to say maybe outright illegal. FBI directed Indiana police to pull over Brian Koberger, seeking video images of his hands. That sounds like a violation of many principles of law. Two charged in Christmas Day attacks on the Washington power grid. This is amazing. I had speculated that we might be faced with leftist terrorists, maybe Antifa people looking to destabilize the world. Turns out they are not political at all. They shut down the whole electrical grid of their location, of their city. They attacked the electrical grid for the purpose of committing a petty thievery. They wanted the electricity to be shut down so that they could go steal a chest in a business. That is some extreme measures, I would say. Extreme measures for a small thievery of a chest. Cloud Warmer says, "Jeff, I have a TRP question. In a future of purposeful genetic engineering and genetic selection, is the requirement of parental race even a requirement? Can two Asian parents engineer a black baby if that's what they choose? What would be the genetic basis for this? Do we need to store genetics for use?" Well, in a phenotypic revolution, it could be in principle possible for parents to do that. In principle, there would be nothing that keeps a parent from saying, "Hey, I don't want to change 30 genes in my child. I want to change 10,000 genes, and I want the child to be like their child." But here's the problem. Evolutionarily, this is not stable. This is like cuckoldry 101. You just got cucked. You're going to be raising the child of someone else. because that child will be imitating the genes of someone else, and they will therefore be closer than this someone else than you. So you just got cucked. You are going to do this for a single generation, and then what? Then the people who do this are not represented in the next generation. So evolutionarily, you're getting kicked out. And starting at the next generation, you disappeared. And there are no more people willing to do that kind of genetic modification. And you get replaced by those people who both want to make the genetic modification, but also want to remain parents of their children. So that's why the world will be dominated by parents modifying the genes of their children, but not too many of them. New guy says, not your genes, not your babies. That is a good one. That is a good one. It totally links my two passions that I have for biology and for Bitcoin. Not your keys, not your coin, not your genes, not your babies. I love it. I'm going to yell this in my next debate on the subject for sure. I love this idea. Thomas Howard says, JF, is the mRNA vaccine technology an early foray into starting a phenotypic revolution? Later, the genetic material inserted will be even more purposeful. You're touching on a very important point. I think it is, in a way. I had made this meme back in the days of the early COVID revolution. It was, you know, the meme with the four levels of brain awareness? And like the first is like, the first was, the virus was made in a lab. The second was, the vaccine is a virus. The third was, the virus was a vaccine in the first place. And the fourth was, both the virus and the vaccine are the revolutionary phenotype. And so, yes, I agree that, you know, there was a CEO of one of the pharmaceuticals who was bragging, 2 years ago, we would have said, would you use genetic technology? And more than 50% of the people would say no. And look at what they did with the COVID vaccine. We were successful at inserting genetic technology into everyone. And he's right. We are one step away from modifying the genome. We are modifying the genome at its closest output, RNA. It's the next step. The next step is DNA. So, yes, in a way, we are introducing this idea slowly that we can play with the genetic signaling as a whole. Elon Musk tweets support for Kevin McCarthy as speaker vote heads into the third day. McCarthy is entering his third day of voting after failing to secure enough votes in 6 ballots. Oh, that was old news actually, because now he's under 9 votes. He got rejected 9 times. Or they're heading toward the 9th round, which establishes a 100-year record. Basically, the last time that this happened, a speaker not being voted in after 9 rounds, was the longest contest in 164 years. Since the Congress, during which states began seceding from the Union to kick off the Civil War. And some people are commenting that this is an improper description, because was it really that states were seceding or that the Union was not fully formed? No matter whether you agree with the Wikipedia phrasing here, Andrew Torba says to this, let's go! And I agree with his observation. This is, it's 11 now. Okay, so 9 round is over already. I'm updated. I just spent 1 hour doing a deep dive and we're already at 11. So basically, The last time it happened led to a civil war in America. Not that it was the cause of the civil war, but it was associated with the disagreement levels that eventually led to the civil war. Interesting. I think it's very interesting. I think that it's beautiful in a way. Not that I want a civil war to happen, but I do want America to realize that it's formed by different people and that it may be time to start about a divorce for the different constitutions, the different constituents of America, the right wing and the left wing, the Republican states, the conservative states, and the Democrats. Stephen Robinson says, JF, I sent you something relevant to the speaker on Gab. Okay. Stephen Robinson sends me a meme about Donald Trump potentially being a speaker. I don't know. I think you can elect the Speaker of the House that is not a person who has been elected. Interesting. I don't know how that works, but I don't think it will happen either. That would be the last thing I expect. The Dan Crenshaws of this world and the Mitt Romney type, you know, those Democrats in Republican disguise, I don't expect them to pass this. All right, what else did we have? Not much interesting news. Celsius co-founder Mashinsky sued by the New York Attorney General for defrauding investors out of billions. I'm suing the former CEO of cryptocurrency platform Celsius Network for defrauding investors out of billions of dollars. Alex Mashinsky lied to people about the risks of investing in Celsius, hid its deteriorating financial condition, and failed to register in New York. Mashinsky tricked hardworking people into investing their life savings into Celsius, promising big financial returns and claiming the platform was safer than a bank. Instead, Celsius collapsed and New Yorkers were left in financial ruins. I think that crypto is bound to be a world of no promise, and you should never make promise. If I was to start a crypto, you know what the first thing I would do? I would do a 1-hour video about why you shouldn't buy my crypto. And I would say, you have no idea of the risk, motherfucker. Don't do it. Don't buy my crypto. And then I would give away the keys of control and I would basically be unable to control it. Like Satoshi Nakamoto. See, lose control of your creation so that you can't be sued by James Letitia of the New York Attorney General. I think this may be the only way to do crypto correctly. Because if you start saying, oh, well, I promise this, I promise that, and oh, it's so solid because of this, you've already entered in a contract and you've entered in the whole domain of security puffing and, oh, this is my security and you should buy it. And you're already, you're legislated above your head. So just create good crypto and let them live on their home without even you being associated with it. John Drake says, that's what we need for video/social media platforms. The Sixth Sense says, with crypto so quickly infested with criminals, it's almost a lost cause right off the bat. Oh no, I don't think crypto is a lost cause at all. Because no matter how many criminals show up in crypto, there's never going to be as many criminals in crypto as there is in the judge system and the politicians and so this alternative decentralized way of settling money is ultimately superior, because at least the criminals of the other side cannot control it. Citadel post record $35.5 billion in revenue for hedge fund securities operation. Okay, well, at least not everyone is going bankrupt. That's a good thing. Watcher.guru says New York regulators fined Coinbase $50 million for allowing users to open accounts without proper background checks. Okay, and this is again, you know, the background checks. We were in a totally unregulated area, and suddenly they're trying to apply all of the expectations of the normie banking world to crypto. And those cryptos that are acting officially within the US will be highly punished, because the real way to get away from these fines and everything, these legal requirements, is just to say, I'm not in the US and I'm never gonna put foot in the US. Like CZ from Binance. They should emulate him. This guy knows. This guy won't show up to Nancy Pelosi, see? And that's clever. What else did I have? Someone sent me nine open secrets that you don't say out loud in academia. He said, you will like this video, Jeff. I'm not sure I like it. You know, everyone knows this. He's going through normie stuff like, oh yeah, in academia, some people put their author name on the article when in fact they've done no work at all. It's like, oh yeah, oh wow, what an edgy revelation. And, oh, you know, the most scientific studies don't replicate. Yeah, okay, yeah, it's because it's fraud. And there's not even the word fraud in this whole video. But the entire academic system and peer review system and the circles of circle jerking that exist in the peer review and editor system is a gigantic fraud. A social fraud to drain money from the taxpayers to do absolutely crap and useless research. It's almost like a race to find the most useless crap possible. Micronova says, I mean, the largest cartels like Sinaloa use cash and shell companies for over 100 years and more. Crypto is just a baby on this field of pirates and cartels. Exactly. So it's not anywhere near corrupted as the real system of money, you know, the real fiat money. And a last news item before I close the show. Zelensky says Russian new mobilization process for major offensive imminent. So that's just Zelensky saying that Russia will launch a new offensive. Zelensky is fully incentivized at making America believe that he's always at the border and that, oh, he needs more support. But maybe he's right. Maybe there's intelligence indicating that Russia would organize a new push. I would be surprised personally that it would be a massive push on the front line. But hey, let's see if it happens. Go away, says JF. Do you think Brian Koberger may have been motivated by feelings of disillusionment towards the academic system? That is a good one. That is a very good one, because it has crossed my mind. It has crossed my mind today as I was thinking about him. And I believe that it can't possibly not have an effect. Because I know the field, I know the PhD, I know what it is, the academia. I've been through it and I've known the people around me. And it's certain that most people in PhD level studies have serious mental health problems, most of them not being attended to in any way. Because the whole thing that gets you through a PhD is this denial of self-suffering. Like, if you want to make it through the end of a PhD successfully, you have to be a kind of sadomasochist to begin with. You have to be like, I don't care about personal suffering. I will self-destroy for the fucking science. I fucking love science. See this old Facebook group that had gone viral. I fucking love science. It's a much darker reality. It's that the people in academia truly fucking love science to the point of self-destruction. Now, the most imaged way I can illustrate this is if you were willing to leave your family and die for a mission in space just because you're going to go sample the sun and then, as part of the mission, as planned, die. Like, be burned by the sun just so you can get that little sample. Most people have the kind of mentality in academia, and depending on their degree of success, you basically have a scale in the PhD studies. There are those who would say without hesitation, oh yeah, I would go gather that sample from the sun. I don't care, burn me. And those people are those who will go through the PhD and be successful. The 50% below, the low part of that range, are those who would say, ah, oh, I don't know, you want me to die for a sun sample? And those people will actually abandon PhD somewhere between the first and fourth year. It's going to be too hard. And in the same way they wouldn't go to the sun and burn for science, they wouldn't also burn 2 or 3 years of their life to get their PhD finished. So Koberger was probably somewhere in that range, but certainly with high mental health issues, unattended for, assumed that it was okay, thought that it was worth it to go through the self-sacrifice and suffering, and yet found himself in the trap of, all right, now I'm just a loser in a fucking office correcting the works of 30 students to determine if they have A plus or A or A minus. And it's very telling that right after his murder, he went back to work, started giving 100% to each of his students. They couldn't believe it. They had A plus, A plus. He didn't care about correcting it properly. So yes, I'm pretty certain that his relationship with academia must have been a major player in his decision to go and commit these murders. Probably a disillusionment, probably a realization that, what am I gonna do? Woman reject me. Now I'm a loser in an office. The only people that idolize me and maybe are these young undergrads that want to have an A plus from me, but they'll be gone. They'll roll over me like a rape train, and there I am, the thin, uninteresting, socially awkward psychopath, just submitting to that suffering just for the purpose of showing that I can do it. Like a Russian gymnast able to bend and jump above a fucking rope. What the fuck am I doing? And he went for the killings. Rodi Lassid says, JF, do we know what his PhD research subject was? I don't know his PhD research subject, but from the Reddit post, he was probably into behavioral forensics. So he was studying from a psychologist's behavioral psychology perspective, what are the things that come to mind at the moment of the crime? And that's what he wanted to do in his Reddit post. He wanted to extract what is the thought process before the crime, after the crime, during the crime. He wanted to see what was on people's mind, but he had a very self-report type of approach that was bound to be as unreliable as any other psychology work. So that's a sad thing. And as far as his earlier work, we know a little more about it. His thesis that he did at the undergrad level was a cloud-based forensic. So it was really about big data and how the multiple ways in which police can use big data to track criminals and find suspects. Ironically, Tillman says, JF, has he given a statement yet? No, for now he's just letting his lawyer do the speak and saying, I have a court-appointed lawyer. That's the only phrase that he said that's meaningful. I have a court-appointed lawyer, and he pointed toward her. We might know more later, but what probably will happen is that his lawyer would highly recommend him to shut up and to never speak through this whole process. So it will be very hard to know more. If we don't get some writings of him, if we don't get some things that he may have said to people before or right after the crime, it's going to be hard to get information from him in the judiciary process if he listens to his lawyer. But if we have a big ego type of guy, a Daryl Brooks type of guy, who fires his own lawyers and says, fuck it, I'm going to give my insight on it, then we might know more. Rodi Lacid says, wow, court-appointed lawyers aren't usually the best. No, they are terrible, but very often they end up with cases that it's not like they can do much. Like, even if you had a genius lawyer, the guy turned on his cell phone when coming back from the scene of the crime. So what do you want? Today, his lawyer said, well, today or yesterday, anyway, on the hearing, his lawyer said to the judge, you know, maybe you could consider bail? And the judge said, no. The way she asked it was like, you know, maybe you could consider bail. That wasn't a solid argument, but what can you say? I mean, a guy who commits four murders doesn't get bail, so it's out of the question. She was basically probably just doing it for saying, hey, I did kind of my job, I tried pulling a little bit on your side, but that's all she can do. It's a bad case to be a liar for. Ladazal says, judge determined he was indigent, guess academia doesn't pay well. It certainly doesn't. Much love. I'll see you all tomorrow.